Thanks very much. We're going to start our session now on feedback from yesterday's conceptual framework breakout sessions. The players are Tom Scott and Anne McGeeken. They've been introduced already, so I will not introduce them again. I believe their plan is all will be revealed in a minute by Anne, but do fire up your machines for Slido input along the way. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you all for your excellent participation in the group sessions. My group did really well, and everything I've heard from the other groups has also been excellent. So the way we're going to run this session is we've got some key messages that we've heard up on the slides. So Tom and I will talk about those key messages and run through the slides for all the examples on the cryptocurrencies. And then when we've done that, we will respond to questions, comments from you. So please do start getting those coming through Slido right from the beginning. And then we will, after we've taken comments and questions on the cryptocurrencies, we will run through the same procedure on the variable consideration. And then if we have time at the end, we might go back to some of the questions that you asked on the conceptual framework in the overview session yesterday that we didn't have time to look at then. Right, so starting with the first example, which was cryptocurrencies, where they were held for investment purposes, and that the only way that you could use these cryptocurrencies was to sell them in the market. There was a predominant view across the groups that both the cryptocurrencies met the definition of an asset, that there was a right that was controlled as a result of a past event, and that it didn't matter that maybe there wasn't a very high probability of an economic inflow, particularly for new coin. That wasn't a factor to be considered in determining whether there was an asset. One thing that seems to have cropped up is some discussion, but perhaps not a lot of discussion, about exactly what that right is. In our group, we talked about it a bit when we were contrasting the sort of right you got with these cryptocurrencies to other rights that had uncertain inflows, such as the right to exploit the benefits of advertising campaigns. And we did have different views about, you know, how you might feel about those different types of rights, but we didn't really bottom out exactly what it was about the differences in the type of rights you get. In terms of recognition, the predominant view, again, was that the holdings in both coins should be recognized. There was more discussion about the recognition of new coins. So new coin was the one where the market was not active. And from the transactions that there were in the market, it looked like the price was dropping substantially. But there was the feeling that if you didn't recognize it, you would get an inappropriate recognition of an expense when actually you had exchanged money in return for an asset. So that was good to see that people were thinking about both the performance statements as well as the statement of financial position. So there were some views about non-recognition if there really was such high measurement uncertainty, and that, again, coming back to what the cryptocurrency could be used for, because it can only be exchanged in a market, it can't be used for cash goods, it can't be used for goods or services. Thanks. So then moving on to measurements, a predominant view again that fair value would give the most useful information. And that was driven by the characteristics, the variability in the cash flows that you were expecting, and also because the contribution to cash flows was that you were going to exchange the cryptocurrencies for cash. It wasn't going to be used in any process. We did talk. There was discussion about historical cost. In our group, we talked a bit about how historical cost, though, also is recoverable historical cost. So historical cost includes impairment as part of its measurement basis. And so you would get as much uncertainty potentially using historical cost as you would using fair value. There were comments about how difficult it would be to determine fair value because there's no sort of fundamentals to it's not like valuing a business. The only thing you can do with these cryptocurrencies is sell them, so you have to have somebody who's willing to buy them. That could make determining fair value very difficult. And that might mean that you wanted to perhaps measure at zero. The majority supported the use of P&L for the remeasurements. And the disclosures focused on, you know, what these cryptocurrencies were, why they were being held, and the associated risks. So that really was a summary of what people were saying about the cryptocurrencies held for investment purposes.
Tom?
So example 1-2, we added something. TradeU Coins, it's traded in an active market. The company bought it. In fact, it had gone up in price by the end of the year. However, TradeU Coins has another feature. There is a platform that uses it, and it uses only TradeU Coin as the medium of exchange. You can't use anything else there. So it clearly has this second medium of exchange thing. With respect to what we got back in this slightly more complex world, many people thought fair value would still provide the most useful information. Not clear entirely in my recollection whether, I think it was largely the active market drove that as opposed to this medium of exchange thing. Then you did get some people suggesting that measurement could depend on the medium of exchange part, which is the second bullet, and there was some concern about whether prices are set in the cryptocurrency. And even here, we had some discussion about, I think people had kind of a range. Some people wanted them fixed in the cryptocurrency. This is sort of highly unlikely, even if you looked at any commodity or something quoted in US dollars or British pounds, the price is going to move a little bit, so it wouldn't be totally fixed. So there was some sort of a notion about stability in prices with respect to the measurement that was in the background. And these cases, as this sort of background variability, there was some question about whether maybe historical cost would be more relevant. And again, that might also be linked to the fact that maybe there's this sort of medium of exchange use that might be different than the investment use. So I think that's the neat part about the second, is it brings in that these things can be mediums of media of exchange, I guess.
Right. On the next example, so mining the cryptocurrency, again, there was a clear predominant view that, as with the other cryptocurrencies, that when you receive the currency, you've got something that meets the definition of an asset and that it should be recognized. On measurement, again, the predominant view was that you should measure them at fair value. Some people thought that it shouldn't matter how you got the currency. That by measuring it at fair value, you were achieving the right margin on your mining activity compared to a margin that you would then get on whatever activity you use the cryptocurrency for in the future. There was one view expressed in a group that if there was, however, a high correlation between the costs incurred and the value of the coins received, then maybe a cost, an accumulation of costs would be a good measurement basis. That would be similar to a more typical manufacturing process, possibly where you make something and the amount that you receive is based on that cost plus a margin. So if it were like that, and we didn't think it was like that in this example, but if you had that situation, you might be driven more to historical cost. The subsequent measurement then would depend, as with the other cases, you'd need to think about how the cryptocurrency was being used and its contribution to cash flows. But as with the previous examples, many people thought that would lead you to a fair value notion. Just one thing, when we were talking about the disclosures, it occurred to me far too late in the day that, you know, we're often criticized for thinking about disclosures only at the end of a project, and that maybe we could have set these case studies up so that people thought about disclosure. What information do you want about these assets first, and then working backwards from having determined what information is useful, you then work out whether that would lead to recognition of anything. But it was too late by then. We plunged into the case study, so we missed that opportunity. Tom?
So the last one, and so there were, as we went through the things, we sort of would add something different. In all cases, there was an investment option. In this case, in an initial coin offering, an entity issues the initial coin or whatever the coin or the token, and usually it attaches some sort of a promise to it. And the promise could be for goods, or it could be for services, or it could be for some share of profit. And so it's a little bit different than the others in that regard. In this case, again, the one question that arose was it an active market or a thinly traded market? And in this case, we weren't really told. We were just sort of given a price on December 31st, so we don't know how active that market was. So people, again, came back, though, that you clearly had a right, that you had an asset. There's a small thing. It just should be holdings of the cryptocurrency. They're not mined. They're issued in this case. They should be recognized. There was some question about the change in the market price of these things from when the entity bought it to the December 31st price. And some people commented, because we really don't know how big that secondary market is, and if most acquirers intend to use the tokens and not sell them, then maybe that signal isn't that strong. We really don't know on the case evidence, so people could have gone either way. General, and this one you actually saw a bit more of diversity. Many people did fair value again. Some liked historical cost, because if you bought it intending fully to use it to facilitate transactions on this platform, then one could argue that it's an input to an indirect sort of use of the asset to achieve cash flows in combination with other assets, and that therefore maybe historical cost would be more reasonable, because all you were really doing here was facilitating the use of this platform. Some even suggested dual measurement, going for fair value on the statement of financial position, historical cost for financial performance. I have no idea what precedent they looked to there. And then again, P&L, and this was fairly uniform. I'll just go back to in all the other cases, there seemed to be a fairly strong view for P&L preference. There were a couple of cases where somebody might think about OCI, for example, up above in that case where you would put one thing on the statement of financial position and so on. But in general, except for some unusual cases, most people wanted a P&L treatment. In this one, major disclosure about the failure of the e-platform to which the value of the tokens, or at least the value and use of the tokens, is linked. So back to you.
So some general observations across all the cryptocurrency examples. And I should just say at the end, after we've looked at the variable consideration examples, we've got a slide about sort of general observations on using the conceptual framework. So we will get onto some direct.
But before you do get into the observations on the crypto, I have an empty screen on the, you know, questions coming in. So I want to encourage people to think about if anything you've heard on the feedback so far has surprised you, what comments you'd like Tom or Ann to make about them, to send them in so we can get them going.
Thank you. So anyway, I was going to say, so we will come on to how you felt that the conceptual framework helped or otherwise in working through these examples. Generally, on the cryptocurrency examples, it's clear that people were quite suspicious about these sorts of transactions and wary about their nature. And I think that sort of ties back to, again, as I was talking earlier about what is the right. And yes, there's a right there, but is it, you know, is this just like gambling? And in some jurisdictions, they're being regulated, or maybe even you're not allowed to use them. All this leads to a definite wariness about these transactions, even to the extent that some thought we should not get involved in standard setting in case we are perceived as giving them legitimacy. I would just say that I think that, you know, it emphasizes the role, the importance of a conceptual framework, that we've got a set of a procedure for going through, for identifying, you know, is there an asset, should we recognize it, how should we measure it. That means that we are looking at the economics and we don't sort of get dragged into necessarily questions of are these good things or bad things that people should be doing. Following up on that, one disclosure that was suggested in our group was that there ought to be disclosure of the corporate governance, you know, around, you know, why is the company entering into these sorts of transactions? What sort of internal controls does it have? What corporate governance is leading to it getting involved in these things? Tom.
I'm just going to pick up the last three. And it says, a stronger case for recognition of cryptocurrencies can be used for different purposes. I'll just remind you, I'll get my wording right. We actually had four activities. There's sort of an investing, there's a medium of exchange, there's a right to exchange for service or good or profit with the issuer, and then there's mining, which I'm going to call an activity because it's not really holding. And then the next question says the purpose for holding cryptocurrencies. And so the investment, the medium of exchange, and the right to exchange are all things you might hold it for. Mining is a little bit different, and in some sense, once you've mined it, you're perhaps in a position where you're going to either hang on to it, which may make you an investor, or you could just eliminate, you know, sell them immediately. So one of the neat things here is that these are complex instruments, and not in their complexity of way they're designed, but their uses can vary. The other neat part that came out, and I think it really illustrates the value of the new conceptual framework, is that different accounting models may be necessary for different transactions. And one of the things that came out that where we have the much better guidance on measurement, I think, is the distinction between the asset existing on a standalone basis to generate future cash flows, which is sort of that investment purpose, and then where the asset may be used in combination with other assets to generate cash flows indirectly, which is a possibility in that last case where you're going to use as a token for facilitating access to a platform. And one of the really nice things about this was I think people use some of the new stuff in the conceptual framework to guide them, and so it was, I think, really helpful that way.
We've got a couple of comments, observations, rather than questions. And I'll just read them out and ask if you want to amplify on them. The other thing, I'm then going to ask each of you to comment whether there was anything that really surprised you in terms of the, you know, surprised you personally in terms of the feedback on those four cryptos. The two comments that we've had in are that ISB should not be engaged in developing standards for cryptocurrencies, something that you, I think Anne commented we'd heard in some sessions. And the second is FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, is considering cryptos as a source of money laundering, and they cannot pass the test of know your customer, which I think maybe is supporting the notion of don't legitimize these items by developing standards. I'll give a personal reaction to that. As much as I would like to not have something added to my to-do list, there has been quite strong feedback, for example, in Accounting Standards Advisory Forum and in other settings where we hear from a lot that we are just falling behind and not focusing on emerging transactions by failing to provide guidance on this.
I would just add on, you know, not giving guidance and accounting for them. If a company buys cryptocurrencies, you have to account for the cash outflow. So you have to do something. If we do nothing, people can decide for themselves what to do. Whereas if we do something, then we are, you know, setting standards, high quality standards for information that is useful to users of financial statements. So whatever you think about these products, if companies are buying them, it's hard to say that we do better by ignoring that fact.
Yeah, just echo, we have a duty to provide standards that are going to provide relevant information, representationally faithful, and as Anne said, people are buying these things. And they're buying them for a number of purposes as well. So some of them may be less reputable, money laundering. Initial coin offering where you exchange it for services might be more reputable. And we have this whole diversity of things, and it's emerging. And I think it's a little bit incumbent on us to be trying to anticipate organizations and users' accounting needs because of just the lead time we need. So I think it's something we always need to be aware of and working on, whether we can get to a point where we would be comfortable actually doing standard settings, another issue. But I think we absolutely need to be aware and engaged.
We've had a couple more comments in on the subject of should we or should we not be. For those who don't have it open, I'll just read them, and then we're going to do an old-fashioned poll of the room just with raised hands about whether we should or, you know, whether you think we should or should not be looking at this from a standard setting perspective. Sorry, I'm paraphrasing as the machine is just refreshing. One was that disagreeing with the comment that we should not be engaging in standard setting, saying the ISB should monitor and at least see how the existing standards could be applied to these instruments. And I think for those people, I'd say look at the paper that went to the Interpretation Committee meeting in September. And then a second question, I think, is in the anti-standard setting camp, which asks, should we also be developing accounting models for pyramid marketing schemes? So I'm inferring from that, but I think it's a pretty strong message, even if it's indirect. So, against that background, can I ask people to say, first, how many people think that the ISB should be considering this from a standard setting perspective, anywhere on the spectrum from monitoring developments and, you know, providing guidance on the application of our standards to actually undertaking standard setting? And then the next choice will be how many think we should not touch it, in part because of the issue of potentially legitimizing it. So all favor in some form of monitoring / standard setting. Show of hands. Say three quarters of the room That's my sense. How many say, no, we shouldn't, the risk of maybe legitimizing is too great? 15 to 20%. Okay, interesting mix. Okay, one more question here for you two. If you had to decide what kind of assets the cryptocurrencies are, how would you classify them? Do you think they should be a separate class of assets, just crypto assets, or do you see them fitting in with, just a crypto version of assets that people already have? Sorry, I'm embroidering a bit.
I think without going too far, one can go and look at the recent Interpretations Committee, and they basically, and not only the Interpretations Committee, there have been standard setters in other countries, Australia and Canada and so on, who've had round tables and so on, looked at this. It's very difficult to apply another, they don't fit nicely into any standard, and so that's what we did in the Interpretations Committee. We thought about that, and now we're thinking some more, but one of the challenges is they don't fit that nicely into any given standard. There's no matter where you go, if you look at any of those discussions, there will be a significant minority in the room who aren't that keen with the result you get. So that's one, and that's what people are doing, and that's one of the reasons we're monitoring it, is if we do nothing, then people will be forced to look for analogous standards and things, and we'll probably end up with a lot of diversity because you can make cases different ways.
Just add a couple of comments that don't answer the question, but just to say that from experience, setting the scope of a standard is often the hardest bit of establishing what you're doing, because there's always grey areas or bright lines that produce the wrong answer. So finding doing the scoping exercise for if we were to do something for what are crypto assets, I can imagine would be really difficult. And I think it sort of reverts back to this question again of what is the right? What have you bought? What is the right? How could we establish a scope for those sorts of rights that is different from other sorts of rights that we wouldn't want to capture? I can see it would be hard. So that didn't answer the question, but it acknowledges it's a difficult thing.
And if you'd allow me to,
yeah, of course,
comment, I'd say that echoes some of the discussions that we had in our group yesterday, which is don't get, I'm looking for Felipe especially, don't get misled by the fact that somebody claims to be a cryptocurrency. You may be just buying into their marketing that they're a currency. It did highlight, the question then would become in a standard setting, whether it's their crypto nature that is the determining factor, or whether, what are the rights that underlie it? Because I think as you walk through, Tom, you were bringing out the difference in the fact pattern, just in the four cases, in terms of what it was you were getting rights to, even if it was also something that was tradable. So thinking about that could be quite challenging. Okay. That's it. I don't see any more questions right now on this.
Right. So we'll we'll move on to the contingent consideration. I think it's fair to say that here the views that were expressed were more diverse than on the cryptocurrency examples. And I think that reflects something that we knew when we issued the conceptual framework, that the definition of a liability and the criteria of, no practical ability to avoid was something that would require standard setting to expand and clarify what we meant by that in particular situations. We didn't think that this was a definition that people would be able to take and say, you know, yes, you definitely have a liability, or no, you definitely do not. But it is something that requires judgment and will almost certainly need us as standard setters to give more guidance in particular situations. So when looking at these examples, we were trying to suggest that people should think about whether you've acquired a single right or two rights, with the idea that that would then lead you to think about whether you had a single obligation or two obligations. The predominant view was that you, in the first example where extra amounts are paid if a particular milestone is reached, the predominant view was that you've got a single right when you acquire a patent, and it's not helpful to try splitting that out. However, then there were different views on whether you actually have a single obligation or more than one obligation. If you went down the line that you thought that there was a separate obligation for the contingent consideration, then again there were different views on whether people thought that was a liability at the acquisition date. And again, that those different views arose from sort of thinking about different things, whether you focus, some people were focusing on, do you have the present ability to avoid the transfer? And other people were questioning, you know, what is the past event in that case? I'll just carry on and sort of, carry on to finish looking at it. If you've only got one liability, then there was a predominant view that you include in that measurement of the one liability an estimate of the contingent amount on some sort of expected value basis. Although a few suggested that you shouldn't think about the probability of the outcome. I personally find that quite a strange suggestion. I would be interested in hearing, you know, more about that from the group where it came up. And then again, different views on the presentation of the remeasurement, whether it is reflected in the value of the assets or if you present it in P&L, you know, what does the effect of those remeasurements mean? And so just overall, there was much less. It seemed that applying the conceptual framework to these examples was leading to much less clear answers, whereas the process for the cryptocurrencies, although, you know, there wasn't one definitive answer and it was clear that different factors were being considered for the different examples, nonetheless the process seemed to work pretty well in leading you through the steps, whereas for these ones, for the contingent consideration, even the process seemed less clear. But I think that is something that we did expect and that we, you know, we are prepared to think about the need of doing standard setting for particular situations. Tom, do you want to?
No, I think you covered. The only thing I is, at least in the group I was in, practical ability to avoid.
Well, Tom.
Apologize. I'll just add one bit of emphasis. I think in the group I was in many groups, practical ability to avoid, which would seem to be a significant challenge in getting kind of a really clear consensus. So I'll just sort of throw that out there as I think that was a fairly common challenge. I'm not going to call it a problem, I'll call it a challenge.
I don't really actually have very much to add on the example too. I mean, most of the groups that discussed these examples thought there wasn't really a difference and they reached similar conclusions. A slight preference for thinking about it as only one right and only one obligation in this view, and that measurement uncertainty was a bigger factor. I think we should stop there and answer questions, take comments on the contingent consideration, and then move on to sort of general observations about the framework.
We've had one question come in that relate to contingent consideration, and it is there any difference between contingent consideration in a business combination and in the example 2.1? If not, what is the problem? I'll let you two first.
If you have a good answer, go feel free.
I have an answer, and I'm also looking in Sue's direction to see if she's going to either run up or send a message, because it is something that's come in to the interpretation committee originally. But is Petrina? I don't see Petrina in the room. I think people have, the question has come up because specific accounting for contingent consideration is specified in the BizCom standard because it is a not unusual feature of those transactions, and the board felt the need to address them in that context. I think many people think that the accounting specified in that standard at least has some tensions with either conceptual framework or the standards that, quote, would normally apply if that contingency arose in a transaction that was outside a business combination setting. So I think that's, while it is guidance that many see as a similar transaction and having to consider it, I think that's why it has come up as a question. Do we have a special model only for business combinations? Or is that the overall thinking that should be applied more broadly? And I think people are just resistant to moving to the it is thinking that should be applied more broadly. So, Tom, I'm not sure if that passes you or if I have a very good answer.
It's infinitely better than the answer I would have provided.
I agree with Mary, and I just add that, yes, so IFRS 3 says this is what you do with contingent consideration, but then there are other standards that give you different answers. So we, at the moment, we have different ways of approaching contingent consideration in different standards, which, I mean, maybe there's a good reason for that, and applying the framework, maybe that though you would get to these different answers in these different situations, or maybe there isn't. And that's why it's something that we think we ought to be looking at.
I see Peter sitting in the back of the room, and given that contingent consideration is a research project, we'll pass on to him two further questions that have come in that I think I'm going to assert the ability to rule on in terms of their more application questions, and so we might skip them, but what is the basis for concluding that variable consideration is not part of the cost of the asset, and is it important to analyze the nature of milestone payments in order to determine the appropriate approach? So I think I'm going to say those are questions that maybe would be answered in a project on standard setting, and pass them to Peter Clark to think about when he's working in directing the work that we do in that area, rather than ask people to answer on the hoof on stage.
Very wise. So, yeah, Tom, I'll just let you move on to...
So, just...
People found them a useful illustration of how you could use the conceptual framework. They were quite positive about structuring the thought process, setting out the right factors, which I think goes all the way back to something Leonard said when we started this discussion yesterday morning. Found it helpful in reaching decisions. Some were clearly more challenging than others. And one of the things we asked you to do was to think about it from the point of view of the conceptual framework and not to go to an existing standard. And I was really pleased at the strong degree of consensus on many issues that people were able to take the conceptual framework and get to answers and agree on answers. And if you kind of go through the cases, there was a lot of support for fair value, there was a lot of support for profit and loss. Again, some subtleties. So I think it was a really good exercise, and I just want to commend everybody here, because certainly the group I was in, we had no problem with everybody staying fully engaged and concentrating right through the 2 hours, and we got great feedback, so I'll thank you for that.
I'd just like to also add that I thought what really impressed me was that the process of following the conceptual framework meant that people weren't talking past each other, that there was an understanding of the issues. As we talked about each issue, people knew what we were talking about. And so you got really good communication of ideas. So even if people didn't agree absolutely with the answer, at least they understood what each other was saying and could see where they were coming from. So again, that was something I think that Andrew and Tom picked up in their first session on the conceptual framework, that it gives you a common language. And so you're not saying one thing and somebody else is hearing a completely different idea. You're talking using the same language, and so you understand each other better. And that was very, very clear, I thought, in our group, that there was this understanding at each stage of what bits of the issue we were talking about at that point.
You didn't ask me to, but I'll throw in a specific comment. I think it harks back to something Tom said that I heard in our group, which is one of the participants with a lot of experience of standard setting said, you know, this is showing me that the conceptual framework really helps break down the process of figuring out what questions you're trying to answer and how to answer them. I really, that this person said, thought it really helped us analyze issues, part of Anne's not talking past each other point. The caveat was, might not always agree with the conclusions you reach, but it helps me a lot to understand how you got there and what the point was where we might reach different decisions. Now, the other thing I'm going to say about the feedback on the session is, I think all the comments have been passed to live so you can see them. Even if we're not talking about them anymore, if you take a look and you want to, vote on vote up the ones that you think are important, that would be of interest to us to see what you thought were comments or observations that had maybe more consensus view in the room, because we have found when we've used Slido before that it's very useful to go back and look at the comments that come in and questions that are raised when we're doing follow-up work in this area. So leave that plea. We did have a number of questions that Anne, you and Rachel were not able to address yesterday in the overview of the conceptual framework. Now, we have gone back to the material that came in, and I just want to maybe ask for comments on a couple of ones. There's a cluster, we started addressing it yesterday, but there's still some that came in afterwards, about the interaction between the new conceptual framework and older standards that had been issued previously and maybe have requirements that are inconsistent with the new conceptual framework. And just, are there plans to go back and eventually, even if not immediately, bring those into line? Is the general thrust of a couple of comments here.
Okay, well, we did look to see whether we thought there were major inconsistencies between existing standards and the new conceptual framework. And we concluded that in many cases, you couldn't determine definitively that there were, because doing so would mean working out how people would have made judgments about what reliability meant. So there was a whole swathe of issues where you couldn't know for sure, but you could certainly interpret the standards as being consistent. There were very few cases where it seemed clear that there was an inconsistency, and the big one is the treatment of levies under IFRIC
21.
Thank you, 21. And that is in I don't know if it's research pipeline or whether it's moved on to active research project looking at that issue. So that was the one that we really thought that we should address. If as time goes by and people, you know, maybe approach IFRIC with interpretation questions, and the question is such that the interpretation committee needs to look at the conceptual framework, and they decide that actually they think the new conceptual framework is not consistent with the existing standard, then that's something that they would refer to the board. But the board is not going to automatically start a project because of a perceived inconsistency between the framework and an existing standard. It would need to assess whether that financial reporting problem, you know, how that fitted into its priorities with all the other claims on its agenda time and its resources. So there is no automatic process of saying that's inconsistent, therefore we're going to start a project to change it.
And am I right in recalling, certainly in the exposure draft, there was either an appendix or a discussion in the basis for conclusion of those potential inconsistencies between what was then the ED and then the existing standards. I think, was that updated and included in the final?
It was in the exposure draft. I think in the final it was summarized.
Yes. So there is still that discussion, I think, in the basis for conclusion about inconsistencies that people, if people want a sense of that, and I think the key point you made was that the board is not going to start a project just to address that inconsistency.
Yes.
That's not going to be the determinant that pushes something onto the agenda solely for that. It's one of the factors considered in weighting up competing claims. Then the other thing, because it ties nicely in with the management commentary session this morning, there's a comment that came in yesterday. And it was asking whether, said, narrowing the definition of primary users of financial statements under the conceptual framework project would have the result of encouraging other sources of financial reporting to replace financial statements as the most important source of information to stakeholders. So maybe if you want to do two things, address whether or not the CF itself narrowed the definition of primary user, and then secondly, what the potential consequences of us using that definition might be.
The conceptual framework, it doesn't change the group of primary users of financial reporting. From the previous conceptual framework. As I said yesterday, we had some feedback that we should narrow it to, you know, like the most residual holders of equity. We had other feedback that said we should expand it substantially to include employees, customers, suppliers. We concluded that being somewhere, you know, in the middle was sort of a good place to be. In terms of our financial statements, are they being replaced as being useful? I mean, there's much more information out there than there used to be. But financial statements still have a sort of unique role, I think, in terms of providing information, in that they are audited, they therefore, you know, carry credibility and a weight. So even if you get information at an earlier stage from an earnings announcement or whatever, the knowledge that is going to be pinned back and compared to information that's in an audited set of financial statements makes the set of financial statements a very important, a fundamental part of the whole financial reporting package. And I believe that many users, many analysts would say that, yes, they still are a fundamental part of the information that they get.
I'll just accentuate one of the things Anne said. And first of all, there's a lot of evidence. Mary Barth has a really nice paper out now about that some of the claims about the irrelevance of financial statements are overstated, and that what you really do need to look, when you look at them in their totality, they are still at least as informative as they ever were. And the second one, which Anne picked up, was setting that aside, so they're clearly relevant, but if you think about the overall informational environment in which people buy and sell securities, so there's the regulators, there's, you know, the nature of them, just the markets, what kind of companies are being traded, and all those things. One of the things that having audited financial statements that are high quality under IFRS does is it's almost like a truing up. All that other information is in, I think, and this was Lane Daly, who's an academic who died sadly of cancer quite a few years ago, said, was that there's a fundamental value in having the confirmation from this source that all those other ones you're much more inclined to use because you know this is coming and you can trust this. So I think they have real value in and of themselves, but I think, as Anne was saying, sort of they're also part of a larger information system, and I think that second one is a very important purpose as well.
I have, there are a number of really interesting questions about the conceptual framework, and it's one that I pointed out to Anne, and then I'll do one more after that, and we'll wrap up the session. The one I pointed out to Anne is question about whether a measurement basis is intended to convey information about A, the object, the item itself, or about the cash flows that the object, the item, is expected to produce.
Well, I would say that it's intended to provide information about the item itself, the asset or liability, because that is it's the asset or the liability that is, you know, the element. It's the right or the obligation, and that's what we're trying to provide information about, not the future inflows or outflows. And I think that's backed up by the what we say in the conceptual framework about, if you look at present value cash flow measurement techniques, they are techniques for estimating a measurement basis. And the measurement basis is information about the assets or liability, the right or obligation, or the income or expenses. So it is about the item itself. And that has implications, I would say, for when you're thinking about, is it useful to give, to base your sort of projected, your cash flow based measurement techniques, is it useful to look at a range, an expected value, rather than the most likely outcome? I think the fact that you're trying to give information about the asset or liability pushes you one way, rather than thinking about whether you're actually trying to give information about the ultimate inflows and outflows. But, you know, that's a view.
And just a small conceptual framework reminder is that the question was narrow. It said, is the value attached and say the statement of financial, what is it telling you? Remember, on the conceptual framework, changes in assets and liabilities is how we produce income and expenses. So once I get 2 points in time, I can get changes. And so again, I'm back to this is a logically coherent, comprehensive framework, and it's the complete product that gives you the information that's going to help you with the future cash flows, and not a single asset value.
Panic about Where is Gloria? Hidden behind the screen for our final Slido session, it has been calmed down. I want to start with saying, can we please show our thanks and appreciation for the work that Anne and Tom did to bring us this wrap-up, and also... Also, that gets shared by those who worked hard to produce with Anne and Tom to produce the slides, capturing the comments in each of the sessions and leading the sessions. So
and Yelena, who put in all the hard work to get it ready for
Yelena,
us.
Yelena, stand up for a moment, would you? Wait, where? Okay. So I'm back with. Yes, closing out on a few admin notes. It's my theme. We have some last Slido questions. One is we're going to do first the evaluation of this session that we just did. So Gloria will bring that up so the questions are live. While you are giving evaluation on the feedback, and I'd say maybe bake into that your assessment of the breakout groups as well, I'll also just give you what's up next before you get to go have lunch. After we do this evaluation of the session, we'll go back and just do a few questions that relate to those questions we asked you yesterday about your expectations for the conference, just asking high level how they were satisfied. Again, we're not going to display those and talk about the responses live, so they'll go on in the background. Second, let me... And one more visual aid. Conference next year, we've got the date and we've got a new location. So you've got glossy postcards to take with you if you want hard copy as the reminder. Do not turn up here next year for the World Standard Setters. When we had our first interpretation committee meeting in our new building, that's what actually launched the our boardroom in our new location, we had only one interpretation committee member go to the 30 Cannon Street and realized very quickly what the problem was and turned up just a little delayed by that. The bigger problem was that the guys who bring lunch also forgot about the change in venue. So we had to do an extra issue while we waited for lunch to come from Mansion House to Canary Wharf. So don't let that happen to you. Remember, there's a new location. There will be lunch today in the Forum restaurant downstairs where we had it yesterday. There's, for those of you staying for the IFAS meeting, a 2 p.m. start with Liesl at the lectern back up here in this room. Now let's see if we've, okay. Gloria, should we, I don't know if we can leave this open and then go to the questions evaluating the conference. And then I think you were also saying that you have a slightly longer feedback form that you were going to circulate by email afterwards, and we would be very, very grateful for any feedback input on that to help us with planning next year's event. It is very important to us in figuring out what content, what mix of activities, et cetera, to include. So thank you in advance for your feedback on that. And that thank you in advance is a good start to further thank yous I should give. First of all, to those who have been presenters, speakers, and to those who stand behind them, preparing the materials, thinking about what all of you need. So, I'm going to ask you for several rounds of applause if we can, as an expression of thanks. Yeah. Second is to Michelle, who is the brains and the organizing force behind this event, Michelle Sansom. You don't know, but she's implanted chips in those of us around her. And when she says World Standard Setters, we obey. And maybe with a little reluctance in terms of what will happen and how the event will run. So special thanks to Michelle on this. And Michelle draws on a lot of support from our education team, especially Matt, and then also Gloria, Min, and Carol, who was helping us yesterday. So thanks to them all. And then the last, this is particularly from the ISB folks here, is for all of you in the room who have done tremendous amount to make this meeting successful by coming all this way, by participating actively, giving us your feedback for doing the prep. It really makes it an important meeting for us. So our thanks to you. And I think with that, we are done. Lunch downstairs, 2 o'clock back here for IFAS.